Okay, thank everybody for reading. Let's see. So I get to do this really cool thing and get to introduce the speaker. So I've met him for the first time tonight for about 2 minutes. I got here a little late and started getting busy setting everything up and was basically, hey, I'm Paul. Hey, Mitchell, how you doing? But Cindy recommended him and originally, I believe, spoke to him. She has a lot of respect for him and wanted to hear his story, but then she couldn't make it here tonight. And I just felt like volunteering for something, so I did this. So with that, I'm going to give you Mitchell, and he's going to give us his story. Thank you.
How you guys doing? Can you hear me all right? All right, my name is Mitchell, and I am a recovering drug addict and alcoholic. And my sobriety date is 11/9/11, so November 9th, 2011. And I remember that day pretty well. I was in Cottage C, and they took away my shoelaces. And the first thought I had when I got into Cottage C was, I could have smuggled something in here. Which is a little crazy thinking about why I was here. So I'll back it up a little bit. They've always told me to share what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. So what was it like? Went to college, University of Georgia, after partying in high school for a few years and felt like I had arrived. And was living the dream. I would see people struggling with drugs and alcohol, but I didn't really struggle. I think I was a functional user and ended up graduating from college. But looking back, I didn't realize that there was a train coming. I was just further away from it than I realized. And so around the time I was graduating college, I started to go through withdrawals. And I remember being in class one time and having to have something delivered to me in class so that I could do a presentation. But at that point, it was a little too late. So I graduated, moved to New York City, and basically tried a geographic change, which worked at some level, but eventually, I found myself once again in some pretty dark places, and I'll just give you a little snapshot of what that looked like. So I went from, in 2010, owning my own company, having an amazing apartment with two dogs and a fiance right next to Central Park, and within about 6 months to a year of really going down that rabbit hole again, I was being extracted out of my father's house in Atlanta, which I didn't live in Atlanta, so I was on vacation. Got extracted from my father's house by a SWAT team on vacation in Atlanta. So the events that led up to that were, we're supposed to be at a wedding. Somehow I ended up in a blackout and breaking down a door and trying to throw someone off a balcony, and so it was not the type of behavior that I would normally do, but this is where it took me. So I had to run from the police and hide out at my dad's house, and then of course he called the police like any good dad and told them where I was, and they came and got me. And I think that was April, May, but I basically was dragged along the bottom for the next 6 months, approximately. Just didn't want to give it up until I ran out of money, had an overdose, and basically called my mom and said, I don't know what to do. Well, she'd been going to Naranon meetings, and she knew exactly what I needed to do. She said, you need to go to treatment. So I remember hearing about a friend who had gone to treatment at Ridgeview, and he said the food was really good. pretty good. It was good when I was here 11 years ago. So I called Ridgeview and I said, you know, I've got these drug and alcohol problems. I need to come in. Well, it was on a weekend, and they said, unless you're suicidal, homicidal, or detoxing off of benzodiazepines or alcohol, we can't take you till Monday. Well, I knew I didn't have it till Monday. So I said, Mom, let's go. So she brought me in, and the first thing I told them, I said, I'm suicidal, I'm homicidal, and I'm detoxing off of benzodiazepines and alcohol. So they took my shoelaces, and I remember showing up in a bathrobe and some fancy slippers. I do remember that. That's a little silly, but it's on brand for my approach to life. And I'm sure most people don't enjoy treatment, but for the first time I felt like I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to be a slave to anything. I mean, I had to suck it up and deal with some uncomfortable mental and physical states, but I actually felt some hope for the first time. So that's basically what happened. And what was it like? I think after I stabilized and quit trying to hit on the doctors and the nurses and the patients, and they threatened to kick me out for doing that, I think I was able to realize, you know, why we're all here, and that's because we need to get well. And so I started to respect that. And then they said, well, you need to pray and make your bed and go to these meetings. And I didn't understand all that, but I didn't really have anything else to do in between cafeteria visits. So I started doing what they told me to do. And surprisingly, even though I wasn't a religious person, I started to feel something. I don't know what it was, but it was better than what I had, and so I kept doing that. And then they recommended I go to the residence here. So I stayed at the men's house up on the hill for 30, 60 days? I don't remember. It was a while. And then they recommended I go to Three Quarters House, and I did that for 90 days, something like that. And then I was sent out into the world, and had a pretty good foundation of going to meetings and had a sponsor. And so I basically got a recovery job and went to about 1,000 meetings my first year. So if I wasn't at work or I wasn't sleeping or eating, I was pretty much at a meeting. And I think that was really helpful. That being said, my first year, even though it was kind of fun, coming alive again, it was pretty challenging. You know, I remember being so broke I couldn't buy a deodorant stick when I got out. And that's a strange place to be in when you owned your own company and lived in a fancy place in a fancy city. So the good news is I found a recovery job helping people, and I worked with people with special needs. I didn't have any salary objective when I got that job. I just wanted to help people. I figured it'd be good for me and good for them. And so that allowed me to work through the steps a number of times. And then I began sponsoring other men. And anytime anybody asked me to tell my story or help with anything recovery related, I typically do it. And I feel some gratitude for that. So it's been 11 years, and through that time, I would have thought it got easier, and some things get easier. I don't have a challenge not getting intoxicated. That's the easy part for me now. But the life on life's terms thing is where working through the steps and having a sponsor and having guys I work with and having a network of people where I call people every day. I still do. Still pray every day. Still make my bed every day. Having that system in place and being a habit has saved me more times than I think I realize. And I say this all the time, but every prayer, every meditation, every meeting, every phone call, I needed every single one of them. I still need all of them. And there are times where I feel like I've got spiritual currency in the bank, and there's other times where I feel like I'm about to overdraft. And that's a pretty scary place to be, because I don't have drugs and alcohol to blame this on anymore. This is me, you know. And that's a little bit more painful than being like, oh, sorry, I was drunk. So it was kind of either grow or get on with dying. So I decided I wanted to grow. And a couple of things I think were really helpful for me to embrace as a sober man. One of the guys when I was in Ridgeview actually was an Emory professor, and he was watching me, and I wasn't acting like a gentleman. And he said, you know, at Emory we have a 3-second rule. And I said, what's that? He said, if you're caught looking at someone the wrong way for more than 3 seconds, you're fired. And I was like, well, that's unfortunate. So, but he's a wise old man. He made a point to me that it resonated with me. Whether you want to call the folks around you God's children or someone's son or daughter, he was able to kind of get through to me and let me know, you know, there's a better way to act. And so to this day, I really try and embrace that. And it, interestingly enough, I started working with tall buildings and trees, doing tree care and climbing a few years back. And I swear I got that job because I'm always looking up. You know, I can't really get in much trouble looking up at trees and looking up at buildings. And I started to notice, like, that needs pressure washing, or there's a dead limb right there. And, you know, to this day, that's served me really well. And then as I've grown my business, I'm pretty certain that people watch other people. And I think if I had had my old behavior still in place, I don't think husbands would be hiring me to work around their wives or their daughters. And so I think there's a lot of really great unintended benefits to some of this good orderly direction, right? And I didn't come in here with a concept of God or higher power. You know, I went to Catholic church and I thought it was a joke. But I will say that while I haven't quite figured out how this all works, there are times where it certainly feels like this good orderly direction allows me to do for myself, or allows for things to be done for me that I couldn't do for myself. And it's time and time again that I'm blessed in a way that just seems a little magical. And I don't need to understand how it works. I certainly have some theories. But what it's like now is, I'd like to say it's a lot easier, but as we grow into maturity and, you know, adulthood, because I was effectively a 28-year-old teenager when I showed up here, so I had some maturing to do, probably still do, but it turns out that that basically when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And so typically there are times where I'm not ready to grow. I don't want to call my sponsor. I don't want to talk about this thing with him because I know what he's going to say. I've been around long enough to know. But there are times where I'm in enough pain where I'm willing to go back to counseling. I'm willing to go seek medical professionals. I'm willing to do whatever's put in front of me. And those are those painful times are the times where I grow. And, you know, I mentioned that the pain of thinking about drugs and alcohol isn't really there anymore, but the pain of life on life's terms, being a father and a husband and a business owner and a member of a community, you know, people die. If you're going to stick around here, you're going to see a lot of death, unfortunately. And, you know, that's painful. And that just has to be experienced. And there's some gratitude and some grace and some beauty in the aftermath of some of that. But it's tough. you know, I can't drink it away like I used to. And I'm grateful for that, but life is still incredibly painful at times, so much so that I'm reminded that without this program, you know, I get so close to the edge sometimes anyway. Without this program, if I put some drugs and alcohol on the pain, prison is my best case scenario. And I've luckily avoided prison so far, but I was headed there when I was using and drinking, and I've been close a couple times in sobriety. And so I think that's just a testament to what this program has done and what it continues to do for me. So if I came through here and just got my blood clean and my head cleared up a little bit and I was healed, I wouldn't need to come in here and talk to you guys. I wouldn't need to keep going to meetings. I wouldn't need to continue to seek out counseling and different professionals to work with. But that's not the case. It's been proven to me time and time again that left to my own devices, if I'm not careful, some of those old behaviors will appear. And if I'm doing things that are harmful or not healthy for other people, and I don't correct that, I'm pretty certain that I will go back to my old ways. And for me, I might as well just skip the whole drug and using part and just go ahead and completely check out, because it's not going to be pretty or enjoyable, and I'm very confident when I say that. So I can talk a little bit about the actual 12 steps that I glazed over. Looks like how much time do I got?
10 minutes.
Okay. So we'll go back to the steps, because I think those are really important. So step one, I feel like I officially worked it with my first sponsor, and he had me basically write out a life story with different things that had happened, and then we talked about it. And I'm sure everybody's first step's different. I'm sure most people don't write out their life story. Different sponsors do different things, so not to say anybody's doing anything differently is not right, it's just how it was presented to me. So we worked through step one in the big book, and I believe worked also out of the NA workbook. But aside from answering, you know, questions in a workbook, it was really helpful for me to write out my life story and then share it with another person, because something interesting happens. I can write out a recollection or a story and not really have much emotional feeling about it. But for some reason, when I open my mouth and I share it with another person, something happens. And, you know, as men in this country, we're taught to suck it up and not be emotional. Or if you're going to be emotional, you know, I guess anger is okay for men in our culture. But to really feel some feelings and share them with another person and have grief over the loss of people or have sadness over, you know, the things we've done, I think there's a lot of therapy in that. And I think it's one of the more painful things that we get to do, but it tends to be really beautiful and really healing. And historically, that would not have been something that would have been looked upon kindly growing up. So I had to start getting comfortable with getting uncomfortable in that way. And step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. That was an interesting one. I remember being at the three-quarter house, and I remember noticing a sunset one morning, and then kind of remembering how I used to hate the sun. No, sunrise. I saw the sunrise one morning. And I remember I used to really despise the sunrise, because that kind of meant the party was over, or, you know, people were going to wake up and be around and doing things and kind of get away with a lot when it's nighttime and people are sleeping. And I remember the birds used to drive me crazy. Just think about how I could go out and stop the birds from making noise. And when I started seeing these sunrises and sunsets and hearing the birds, it wasn't the same. And I thought, I think what I'm experiencing now is a little bit of sanity. And then it wasn't until I had those feelings in different ways where I could compare them and realize how insane the life that I was living was. But I was surrounded by people doing the same thing, so it seemed like everybody was doing what I was doing. It turns out that's not accurate. So I think through the prayers and the meditation, I think I just started to have some appreciation for some of these little things. And I started to get some gratitude. I think doing things for other people, even though they were small when I was early on, opened the door for people, or returning the shopping cart. Those were esteemable acts which were told to me that would help me build up self-esteem. And so I was explained as a drug addict and alcoholic oftentimes were egomaniacs with inferiority complexes, which is a very paradoxical arrangement, but it seemed accurate for me because sometimes I felt like I was, you know, the king of some crazy world, and then other times I would just feel like, you know, the dog's got it better than me, and, you know, he lives on the floor. So that oscillation back and forth from feeling great to feeling like scum and back and forth, that to me is really what the difference between feeling like an egomaniac and then having an inferiority complex. You know, we act oftentimes when we're using with liquid courage and bravado, and really I think a lot of times when we sober up, we feel inferior, and so we continue the cycle to feel better. And I do remember one of the things that I had to have a flashback on was when I was getting ready to go into treatment, and I was in a terrible state. I remember the doctors had to give me something to calm me down, and then I remember hearing my mom talk to him about how she was saying I was self-medicating, and I never even considered that or thought about that. But, you know, as I'm flashing back to that during my first few months, it made sense. I was medicating for whatever reason. I didn't know at that time what it was. But I certainly didn't like the way that I felt pretty much my whole life. And when I found drugs and alcohol, all of a sudden I felt great for a while. And it wasn't until they quit working that I felt like I really had a problem. But for a good long while there, it was like I had found the magic solution to life. Everything tasted better, felt better, smelled better. I mean, everything seemed enhanced and better. So, as it turns out, what I was self-medicating was depression. And I didn't get to really experience what that was in its true raw form until being sober for a while. And typically in the winter times, for whatever reason, I just don't quite feel like myself. And so I've had to really focus on doing things and working with professionals to try and make sure that that's managed, because after going through a couple rough spells like that, it was very clear to me why we relapse. I'm no longer confused why people relapse, hurt themselves, or hurt someone else. I'm never surprised by it anymore. I get it. You know, I have a lot of thoughts that I don't like, and I have to work through those. And I remember acting on those thoughts, and that's kind of scary to think that I might do that again. So I think with all that being said, I think people come in here for different reasons. Certainly know not everybody that comes in here has, you know, a depression diagnosis. That was just my story. But I feel like no one's perfect. No one's got a perfect life. And so everybody's struggling with something. That's been my conclusion. So when I'm not surprised when tragedy happens, I'm surprised when people get sober. I'm surprised when people somehow, typically with the help of their community, their friends, their family, pull it all together for long enough to get the clarity to do the healing. And it's not the most complicated thing to understand what is done in these rooms. It's just very difficult to do it. Or at least it has been for me. And so the good news is when I decide I'm going to do it and I show up to do it, it's not that hard. Simply trying to be a better person and trying to learn how to live a little bit better in a way that you're going to be able to hopefully sleep better at night, and in a way where you're not going to be concerned as much with how people are viewing you and what they're saying about you, because typically you know what's happened. So, you know, you're not worried about what you did when you can't remember what you did. So that's good. Sometimes I still do things that I wonder if people heard me say something or do something. And so, you know, still working on some anger management stuff to this day. And I imagine that'll probably be something that I work with the rest of my life. But it's gotten a lot better. Haven't had the police come for me in 11 years. That's been kind of amazing. And I think, you know, getting into these steps really helped with that. So it said, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to care of God as we understood him. That's simply showing up and coming to these meetings, finding a sponsor, working with some of their guys, and being willing to do what was asked of me. And my sponsor asked me to come here today. And I was not only happy to say yes, I was honored to be able to come back here, because, you know, 11 years ago I was sitting back there and listening to a girl talk. I remember pretty clearly. I remember what she said. So, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. It's pretty straightforward if you work through the book with someone. It can seem a little complicated, but what I found is you can't really mess it up unless you don't do it. So the great news is, if you're like me, you'll get the opportunity to do it again. So anything you left off or missed, I probably worked through the steps 6 or 7 times now. And so each time I do it, it's normally when I'm struggling, I need to grow through something. And then when I go through these steps again, not only does it help me and to pinpoint what I need to do better, but then it allows for me to better help the next man. So, step 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. That one was pretty big for me because there was some stuff that I really didn't want to talk about. And, you know, domestic violence is not something that is easy to talk about. I had a handful of things that I would have liked to just take to my grave and never revisit. But I was convinced through people talking in meetings and speakers that if I did not share those things and I did not process them verbally out loud to another human being, that they would continue to keep me sick. And that's what I found. I found that the more of these things I shared, the lighter I felt. Because before, when I was trying to get sober or getting sober, I would just constantly think about these things. I have these flashbacks, and they would just really disturb me. And it doesn't happen very much anymore. Certainly a little bit more manageable, that's for sure. So, number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That's a tricky one, because I certainly was ready for the drinking and the drugging and the way I dealt with romantic partners, if you'll put it that way. I've never been faithful to anybody, and it occurred to me at some point that that's not the man that I want to be. And so I had a couple things like that I really wanted to work on and fix. And so I did. And then, but I wasn't ready to give up everything. You know, there was some stuff I had to go through and work through again. And I'll give you a good example. It's a little bit more lighthearted. I like to buy nice stuff. That can be problematic. So that's one that I still work on to this day. I think I might have got it fine-tuned, but there's a whole host of things that when I look at them, I'd like to improve, and when I've improved them, my life tends to get better. So, seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. So once I've got these down on paper and I'm ready to have them removed, pray to have them removed. Now, there were some of them where I pointed out, I'm not really ready for this. Well, I pray for readiness, and eventually it tends to come. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I jacked this one up royally, so I'll share with you what I did, and hopefully you'll not do the first thing I did. So when I was in treatment, I started writing people letters. I didn't realize you're supposed to have a sponsor. I just saw this list and I got to work. And I'm embarrassed to think about what I said in those letters, if they made it to where I sent them. But I would highly recommend, if anybody's gonna go through these steps, working through them with a sponsor and taking your time. Typically what I've understood from working through these steps is people don't really wanna hear from me, or they need some time before they hear from me. I'm pretty sure there are people to this day that don't want to hear from me. And I'm okay with that. If the time is right, it'll happen. If not, then sometimes the best thing I can do with living amends is just to behave the best I can and leave people alone. And so that's taken a lot of practice, because I think we can kind of selfishly want to make amends in a way that's not helpful to the other people. And sometimes if we've inflicted trauma on people, they just don't want to be around us. And that's okay. Some of those amends were challenging to make, financial amends. But the interesting thing I found is most people that wanted to hear me, that I reached out to, really just wanted one thing. They wanted me to keep doing whatever it is I'm doing. You know, they knew one person, and a different person showed up, and this person's way more safe to be around than that person that they used to know, so they're like, just keep it doing whatever you're doing. And, you know, some people want their money back, and other people, they just want you to keep doing what you're doing. So I had to pray for willingness to deal with some of that financial stuff, for sure. And that's, you know, the made direct amends. And I probably have some more amends to make. I remember sitting there 4 years sober. I'd already gone through the steps twice, and it hit me. Oh, I borrowed a canoe from this guy and never brought it back. And I don't know what I did with that canoe, whether I sold it or what. But anyway, so you don't know what you don't know until you know it. So once I realized I'd done that, I might have a little brain damage. I reached out to the guy, and he said he didn't even remember the canoe. So had one other amends that I have a hard time not smiling when I remember it. So I have this habit of buying things that I like. And so I was in New York City, and I was going to buy these suits from the Ralph Lauren store on Madison Avenue. And they had these shoes that you could wear when you're putting your suit on, they'd mark your pants so they know where to cut them. Well, the shoes were amazing, and they fit me perfectly. And I tried to buy them from them. They're like, they're not for sale. It's like, everything's for sale. How much are the shoes? They're antiques, you can't buy them. So I was like, all right, so next time I was getting a suit, same thing. They won't let me buy them. So the third time I was going to get a suit, I put them in my bag and I took them with me. I don't know how much these shoes are worth, but I still have them, and I tried to give them back. But when I called them years later and told them that I'd been wearing those shoes for a few years, they said they had to talk to their management, and then they said, you can just keep the shoes. We don't want the shoes back. So I don't wear those shoes very often. It's funny, I used to like to dress up when I was intoxicated. I felt like I was wearing some kind of invisibility cloak. Like if you have a suit and nice shoes on, people don't know you're a drug addict. But now that, you know, I'm sober, I just want to wear like comfortable cotton stuff that stretches a little bit. That's the best thing for me. So I guess I got comfortable in my own skin a little bit, which I wasn't before. Kind of felt like a dressed up garbage can for a while there. And now, you know, I feel like I have to hide all this garbage. And so I can just have a little bit more humble attire. I don't have to go to the dry cleaner. So 10, continue to take personal inventory when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. So continue to take personal inventory. You know, we keep talking to our sponsors. A lot of people will do a daily written inventory. I've been a little bit rebellious in that way, but I wouldn't recommend you follow my lead if you can get yourself to do a daily inventory. I think that's probably one of the best gifts you can give yourself. It's been my admitted weakness with these steps. But the good news is I normally don't wait until nighttime. I call someone. And so that's been really helpful. And typically people are willing to tell me how they feel about it, what they see. And, you know, I call 3 to 5 people that I really trust that have some sober time, that are respectable people. I normally get a consensus. Normally 3 or 4 of them say the same thing, and that's pretty much what needs to be done. I don't know why, but this whole promptly admitting when we're wrong thing came easier to me early on, and now it is just so painful for me to admit that I'm wrong. And so I don't have any great advice there, but it's certainly been very helpful to admit when I was wrong promptly, because what I do know is it'll affect me. I have anxiety or stress over it until I admit it. So the sooner I can do that, then the less I'm stressing myself out and being anxious. So there's that. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and try to carry that out. The prayer's been huge for me. The meditation's been really huge for me too. And the prayer kind of came easy. Meditation to this day might be harder than when I started. I was at a point where I was meditating almost every day for 20 minutes, and now it's so difficult because my life is so full and so busy that it's hard. I got a toddler. It's hard to find the time to meditate. So that's one of the things I need to rededicate myself to, and that's what this system has really put in place for me, is a rededication and then falling back, and then a rededication to these practices, because they've helped me build a life that I couldn't have known I wanted. And if I were to describe it to you right now, you'd probably think I'm lying. That's okay. I don't need to go through the details of my life. My life's really beautiful, and I could have never imagined that I would have wanted such a wholesome, beautiful, orderly life. But I love it. And Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So the carrying the message part's kind of been the easy part. So this for me is kind of easy. Practicing the principles in all of our affairs has been real tough, especially in the business world. So still working on that. But I'll close with this. 12 years ago, I was dying slowly, and I was doing it to myself, and I was in and out of psychosis. I convinced myself I had cancer, and rather than go to the doctor, I just decided I was going to continue getting loaded 24/7 until I died. But luckily, I ended up in these rooms, and now I've got an amazing company that I built with an amazing family. With an amazing home, an amazing property, and that has allowed me to be in a position to start a nonprofit on the side where I help people with special needs. And in the past, all I really wanted to do was hang out with drug dealers and people in the nightlife, and now I'm in bed by 9 p.m. most nights, if not earlier, and I'm up at 5 to 6 a.m. and except for when I'm kind of stuck between my ears, my life, when I can look around, is really beautiful. And I don't think it would be that way if it wasn't for these rooms. So thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Mitchell. It was interesting to hear somebody else's look on the 12 steps when they did it.